John Kenneth Galbraith was an economist, but in his 97 years, he was so much more. Prolific writer, Galbraith authored more than 40 books, including The Great Crash of 1929, The Affluent Society, American Capitalism, and The New Industrial State. He was also a close advisor to John F. Kennedy, who appointed him ambassador to India, and later to Lyndon Johnson. Galbraith was known for his exquisite writing style and his ability to turn a phrase. In fact, he coined the term conventional wisdom, as well as many others. So talented a writer was he that one economist said that reading Galbraith's Affluent Society was like reading Hamlet. You finally realize where all those quotations come from. And Rick Holt, who was a professor of economics at Southern Oregon University, took on the daunting task of combing through John Kenneth Galbraith's letters for his newly published book, The Selected Letters of John Kenneth Galbraith. Galbraith really was a prolific writer, but at one point, Rick Holt, he insisted his letters never be published, but then he changed his mind. Why?
Yes. So it was during the time of the tragedy of John F. Kennedy's death, and his brother Robert Kennedy was trying to put together where should we house Kennedy's materials, his letters, and documents from his presidency. And initially it was thought it was going to be close to Harvard University, and actually where the Kennedy School of Government is right now. But there was a big debate between Robert Kennedy and that of Galbraith where to put President Kennedy's material. And it finally was put on where the President Library is now, right outside of Boston. But anyway, there was a debate between Bobby Kennedy and Galbraith about the letters. And at that particular period of discussion, Galbraith decided that he did not want his letters to actually be published. But then what happened in the 1990s, Galbraith decided to publish a very small book of his letters or correspondence with President Kennedy. And at that time, he decided to open up all his letters to the public.
So Galbraith got his start in government service during the Roosevelt administration and became, during his career, one of the real standard bearers for American liberalism. You know, in this day and age, the terms liberal and conservative get thrown around a lot to the point where I think they don't really mean much. They're sort of like, you know, somebody says, well, you're liberal. Everybody knows what that means. But then if you ask them to define it, they really can't. If you watch Fox News, liberal is sort of an all-purpose insult. Mm-hmm. So what exactly was the core of Galbraith's American liberalism, the philosophy that he represented for his whole life?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And what he brought out is that there are liberal conservatives, liberal liberals, and liberal radicals. And what he meant by that comes from actually a debate he had with Milton Friedman. The debate between Friedman and Galbraith was that Friedman argued that he was more liberal than that of Galbraith. And what Milton Friedman meant was that he was a classical liberal, coming back from the 18th and 19th century from the Enlightenment, particularly from the work of John Locke and that of David Hume. And so the conservative movement actually is part of the Enlightenment period of liberalism. So actually when we talk about conservative liberals is that they actually come from the same root. For David Hume, what liberalism meant was to break away from the church and to support individual rights, and that the government's role was particularly to protect private property, to protect people through cases of war, and to support individual liberties. And so in some senses that the conservative definition comes from that tradition. For Galbraith, what he considered him to be was an American liberalist and coming from the tradition of that of Roosevelt. And what that meant for Galbraith and how he defined American liberalism was that, first of all, it was that of dealing with practical problems. In other words, we had the Great Depression, and there had to be a response to that. So what we found was that it wasn't individuals who were responsible for being unemployed or their poverty or the dire economic circumstances that were created by the Great Depression, by the economic conditions there. And so that gave a role to that of government's involvement to try to deal with these economic problems. And so Galbraith looked at Roosevelt dealing with three things, that of the World War II, that of the Great Depression, and then the main transition in the economy that liberals need to take responsibility to help all. Then the last aspect of how he looked at American liberalism is to create a sense of community within the United States. And he looked at leadership, particularly presidential leadership, as showing that we are a community, is that we take responsibility for each other, is that when people are facing difficult times, when they're having problems finding a job or health care issues, is that we act as a community to help and to support one another.
It's the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio, and our guest is Rick Holt, who is a professor of economics at Southern Oregon University. You can join the discussion at 800-838-3760 or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. You know, this one thing I notice about this book is that it's more than just a collection of letters. There's a lot of editorial commentary that you provided, so it actually has this historical flow and can almost be read as kind of an autobiography of Galbraith, although he wrote one himself.
Yes, and what I wanted to do with the book, it took me some time to think about what I was going to do with the letters. And it's an interesting story how I came about on the project. Jamie Galbraith, who is Ken Galbraith's youngest son, who's also economist, is a very good friend of mine. And after his father's death, I approached him about his father's letters. And he wasn't quite sure if there were any and where they were at. But he said most likely if there were letters, they would be at the Kennedy Library. And so I went to the Kennedy Library and found boxes and boxes of letters. And then I went to the Radcliffe Institute Research Institute, found boxes and boxes of letters. And then finally I went to the Sterling Library at Yale University and also found boxes and boxes of letters. And so I accumulated over 40,000 letters. And so what to do with all this material? And I decided I wanted to tell a story.
And we're going to hear that story and unpack some of those boxes of letters of John Kenneth Galbraith in just a moment after the break. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio with Rick Holt, who's a professor of economics at Southern Oregon University and the editor of the newly published Selected Letters of John Kenneth Galbraith. And we were talking before the break about how you came to this project and you discovered boxes and boxes and boxes of John Kenneth Galbraith's letters. Were you approached by the Galbraith family to take on this project, or was this a project that you thought you wanted to pursue?
Well, basically, it was a project that I wanted to pursue. But as I mentioned, I was a very close friend with Jamie. And
John Kenneth Galbraith's son.
Yeah, the youngest son. And then I became very close friends with the other two brothers, Alan and that of Peter. And so I received tremendous amount of support from the whole family to take on this project. And two other people that were very, very helpful were Christopher Buckley, who's the son of William F. Buckley, and that of Steve Schlesinger, whose father was Arthur Schlesinger. And so I had a group of people that were very close to Ken, very intimate family members, close friends, associates that were very, very supportive throughout the whole project. And so it took me years to accumulate all this material, and then I had to decide what to actually do with it.
How many letters were there in total?
There were probably 80,000. I collected 40,000.
Wow.
And these are small notes, you know, memos and things like that. But there are also many large letters of 10, 12, 15 pages. And also I decided what to do in the book was to go beyond the letters. And if there was a draft speech that was connected to a letter, I added that. So all the material in the book is associated with some letter or some memo. But there are draft speeches. One of the most interesting draft speech is that right after President Kennedy's death, the day after his death, Lyndon Johnson approached Galbraith to write his speech that he would give to Congress 3 days later.
That was a really moving speech, and yet it was never delivered.
It was not the one that was delivered, and the one that was delivered was the one that was written by Ted Sorensen, who was the speechwriter for that of Kennedy. And my theory about that was that if you read it carefully, Galbraith was very critical of the United States' involvement in Vietnam. And I think that for Johnson, is that, as the letters also show, was that he wanted Galbraith to focus on the Great Society domestic programs mm-hmm. and not on Vietnam. And Galbraith wouldn't do that. But again, I wanted to tell a story about Galbraith's life, but also I wanted to tell a story about America and America's history, and particularly the story about American liberalism and its roots and where we are now and where it's going to go. And I have some letters at the very end of the book between Hillary Clinton and that of Bernie Sanders. And you can see the tension that mm-hmm. we still see today going on in the Democratic Party. And then you have Galbraith's comments about that tension. It's a fascinating one. And one of the interesting things about the book is that he constantly made these predictions, and they almost inevitably turned out to be true. And I think that the book will be insightful for those that want insight about major changes that might occur within the Democratic Party, particularly in the next election cycle.
Well, getting back to that speech that he wrote for Johnson to deliver after Kennedy's assassination, which wasn't chosen, someone else's, Ted Sorensen's speech was chosen. There are a few letters from Galbraith praising the speech that was chosen. He had a real generosity of spirit in that way.
Well, one is that he had a tremendous amount of respect for Ted Sorensen and appreciated how talented he was. And also what's interesting, what the book brings out, was that he worked very closely with Ted Sorensen with President Kennedy's speeches. For example, his first inauguration, and in fact, this is his only inauguration speech. And Galbraith came up with some very important lines. The one that we know that out of the speech Galbraith wrote was, "Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate." And so Galbraith worked very closely with Sorensen in editing almost all of Kennedy's major speeches. In terms of Johnson, also what the book brings out, his state of message to the country, Galbraith wrote many and many of those speeches. And what's more important, I think, to bring out was that the war on poverty, the Great Society, mm-hmm. one of the legacies of Johnson, would not have been what it was if it wasn't for Galbraith. He played a tremendous important role in defining the concepts of the Great Society. Unfortunately, the Achilles heel of Johnson and what he believed for American liberalism was the war in Vietnam.
And there are a number of letters where Galbraith is kind of goading Johnson along. He's saying, come on, let's get with the program here, really supporting that Great Society and encouraging him in that way. So he was obviously a very close advisor to Lyndon Johnson. He was also close to President Kennedy, who named him ambassador to India.
That's right.
And can you characterize, because there are lots of letters between Galbraith and JFK, as well as Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Can you characterize his relationship with the Kennedy family?
Yeah, it was a very unique relationship. And his deep respect for Kennedy comes out. But one of the nice things about the book is his relationship with Jackie Kennedy. And in fact, what's one of the unique things about the book is that it has three letters published by Jackie, written by Jackie Kennedy. And I believe that this is the first book that has any letters written by her published since her death. And basically it took a lot of effort to persuade Caroline Kennedy to allow me to publish these three letters. And in fact, I have hundreds of letters between Jackie Kennedy and Galbraith. And it's an interesting story how I was able to get those three from Jackie. And so I initially approached Caroline, and I would like to publish some of your letters from that your mother wrote to Galbraith. And everyone told me that she was going to say no. And Steve Schlesinger came out with a book of letters by his father, and Jackie wouldn't even allow him to publish a line. And everyone said, you know, this isn't going to happen. And I said, I'm going to try. And so she wrote back an interesting letter. She said, and I thought she was just going to say no. And she says, what I'll allow you to do is to pick two letters, and then I'll review them, and I will decide. So I had to think very carefully about what two letters I was going to choose. So I couldn't pick the most emotional ones. And so what I decided to do was to pick three. And I said, well, here's my three, but these are my two. But if you allow me to do three, I'd be really happy. And she allowed me to do three. And so that's one of the wonderful things about the book. But also I was able to publish a lot of the letters that Galbraith wrote to Jackie. And what you find is this this love and this intimacy and this friendship that is so wonderful. And when President Kennedy died, Galbraith felt like a father figure, that he had to take care of her. But also, you know, what's going back to your question about Galbraith's relationship to the Kennedy family was that they respected Galbraith. And there's some interesting letters here where he was very critical of the family and their positions, political positions. And also he wrote a letter to Edward Kennedy saying that the Kennedys need to be careful about this Camelot image. And really what we should be focusing on in Washington aren't these grand parties at the White House, but, you know, just who we are as politicians serving the basic needs of people. And we don't need to have fancy dresses or tuxedo parties. In fact, what we should have are high school kids coming to the White House. And so he is very critical of this Camelot high society image.
Mm. We're talking with Rick Holt, who's a professor of economics at Southern Oregon University and the editor of the newly published Selected Letters of John Kenneth Galbraith. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. And that's what we just heard from Robert in Mount Shasta. He says, I'm grateful to know that Galbraith's letters have been preserved and published. Letter writing is a lost practice. Will we someday have the emails of current figures, or worse, the tweets? We were actually talking about that just before we went on the air, the collected tweets of Donald Trump, perhaps, in the future. Anyway, Robert says, I'm curious, since Galbraith's letters once sent were no longer in his possession, how is it possible to collect them?
Well, basically, what Galbraith did, and it was a process, and it didn't happen overnight, was that over about an 8-year, maybe even 10-year period, but over an extended period of time, he reviewed his material and then gave it to the government, which meant that once he gave it the copyright to the government, these letters and these other papers became public. And most of the letters are housed at the Presidential Library, Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston, but there are also letters at the Radcliffe Research Institute, and then also at Yale University. And there's scattered letters at other places, but primarily there. And once Galbraith gave the copyright to the United States government, they automatically become public.
So we've been talking about John Kenneth Galbraith largely as a writer and a political figure, but he was also an economist. And there are some exchanges in the book between Galbraith and Milton Friedman, who you mentioned earlier. Some of those exchanges are a little frosty, but they seem to have a fairly good relationship. But what is Galbraith's position in the world of economics? How is he viewed in your field of economics?
Well, I think what's interesting about Galbraith's work, and part of the reason why I wanted to go through his letters, is that there's two ways which you can have an impact on the profession. One is through writing academic articles. and you respond to someone's argument and they respond to yours, and it's very esoteric and very well footnoted. The other is that you come up with ideas that people don't appreciate at the time, but later on they recognize the insights of those ideas. And I think that Galbraith's major contributions to the economic profession falls in the latter category. And his insights about the balance between public and private goods, his concern about quality of life, his concern about sustainable development, his concern that we're not going to be able to achieve the good life or increase the standard of living in the United States by undifferentiated growth, is that we need to think about the relationship between public and private goods and what the private sector is not willing to provide the public sector also. But again, in the early 1960s, he says we need to redefine the meaning of the standard of living. The traditional standard of living, as defined by economists, is increasing in the GDP or economic growth or per capita income. And what Galbraith says, you know, in an affluent society, we should be thinking about three different things. One is that of social opportunity. Mm-hmm. People should have economic opportunity. The third is overall improvement in quality of life. And the third is that of environmental sustainability. And to be talking about this in the late 50s, in the early 60s, and was extremely insightful. And the present academic work I do now is related to issues of environmental sustainability and redefining the standard of living. And I've learned a lot from Galbraith's work from that.
One of the criticisms I've read of him from economists is, well, he wasn't a very good theorist. He didn't really propose any grand new theories of how the economy actually works. He wasn't, in other words, focused on sort of quantitative measures of the economy.
Well, I think that, first of all, is that he decided to use words instead of numbers. But more importantly, I think that, and again, going back to my earlier comment where he was ahead of his time, I think one of the cutting-edge areas in economics today is an area called complexity economics, which goes beyond the traditional models of neoclassical that we see, which I teach my students. And basically my argument, and I also tell this to my students, is that the theoretical models that you see in your textbooks is dead. Neoclassical economics that is taught is dead. And what I mean by that is that there's no new cutting-edge work there. And the new cutting-edge work now is in experimental economics, behavioral economics, looking at complexity issues, the interactions, environmental, sustainable. So models, the economic profession, in my view, is really at an edge of change. And I think that Galbraith provided some very insightful ideas about where that change will happen.
Mm-hmm. Can we skip back to the 1940s for a moment? Because there's some really fascinating letters early in the book that you collected that Galbraith wrote when he was in Europe and then in Japan, because he was sent to Germany to sort of evaluate the effects of Allied bombing on the
right.
conduct of the war. And then later, after the destruction of Japan by the atomic weapons, was sent there. And there's some really fascinating historical detail in those letters.
Yeah, I think that and also I think that most of the letters that I have there had a lot of choice of what I could put in there. But I decided to, in the 1940s, during that period of time, to put the letters that he wrote to his wife, Kitty. And the reason why I decided to do that is that they're so descriptive. And I think that actually anyone who's interested in World War II should read those letters, because they're so descriptive of what Germany looked like right after the war. And in fact, what happened was that Roosevelt died in April 12, 1945, and it was the day after that Galbraith was asked to go to, first of all, to Great Britain and then to Germany. And so the Nazis had not quite surrendered. And so he was in Great Britain during that transition. And his description of Great Britain during that period of time and then Germany right after the Nazis surrendered is extremely insightful. And he talks about the German soldiers and the German people and then the Russians who came into Berlin and what Berlin looked like right after the surrender. So it's all very, very descriptive. And if you're interested in World War II, I highly recommend reading those letters. And then after he did a study in Germany, he was asked to go to Japan. And then again, what you have is the description of the people and the living conditions and the trauma of the war on the Japanese people. So I think it's a lovely period of time in the book. And if you really are interested in World War II, again, something you might be interested in.
Rick Holt is a professor of economics here at Southern Oregon University and the editor of the newly published Selected Letters of John Kenneth Galbraith. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. As we get into the 50s, Galbraith kind of gets into his really prolific career as a writer. He published a lot of very, very influential books during the 50s. He was not really a part of the Eisenhower administration, but was definitely a major figure, becoming a major figure in the intellectual life of the United States. I want to talk a little bit about that and then his relationship with a very conservative guy named Buckley. After the break, here on the Jefferson Exchange. The final segment here on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm John Baxter, and today for Jeffrey Riley. You can be a part of our conversation by calling us at 800-838-3760 or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're talking about one of the major intellectual figures of the 20th century in the United States, John Kenneth Galbraith, who was a prolific writer, economist, professor, advisor to presidents, ambassador to India, many, many other things in his life. And as we left it before the break, we were sort of looking at what Galbraith was up to during the Eisenhower years, because he was a speechwriter for Adlai Stevenson and was kind of on the outs politically because we had a Republican administration.
Yeah, the 50s is a very interesting period. Galbraith finally got tenure at the very beginning of the 1950s. And it was a difficult battle. And in fact, President Conant of Harvard University to the trustees said that he would resign if they blocked Galbraith's tenure. And that's a very long story. But related to that, it was that now it's in the 1950s. Galbraith is in his 40s. And up to that time, he had only co-authored one book and wrote maybe a handful of academic articles, and that was it. And then after that was that it was just a deluge of books, articles, hundreds and thousands of articles and 40 books or whatever. And so one of the questions in my mind is that what caused this change? And also what's interesting if you read the letters was that there was a change in his writing style. So the writing style that we know of Galbraith with his wit and his way of having a sentence that all of a sudden at the very end of it jumped out at you, it was something that developed over time. And I think that the factors that led to his change in writing had to do, one, getting tenure at Harvard that provided him with a lot of academic freedom and why I support tenure. And secondly was the tragic death of his second son, Douglas, who died of leukemia. And it was a tragic, tragic emotional moment for Galbraith. And what's interesting, he never mentioned it emotionally till 1963, when Jackie Kennedy, 2 months before her husband was assassinated, lost a child at just a few days after its birth. And Galbraith wrote a letter to Jackie telling him telling her of the emotional feeling that he went through when his son died. So there was emotional aspect, there was freedom there, and then Galbraith just took off. And then in 1952, his friend Arthur Schlesinger asked him to join Adlai Stevenson's campaign for the presidency as a speechwriter. And he wrote many, many of Adlai Stevenson's speeches. But what's interesting, in 1956, the acceptance speech that Adlai Stevenson gave, Galbraith wrote, and it's in the book. Now, what happened was at the very last moment, when Stevenson was about to give this speech, his acceptance speech, he decided to write his own. And it was considered a devastating failure. And everyone said that if he had read Galbraith's speech, he probably would have won the election in 1956.
Fascinating. Well, there's so much to talk about with John Kenneth Galbraith. I want to skip quite a ways forward in time and talk about the 70s and 80s, where we have, among other things, the Reagan Revolution, the real ascendance of Milton Friedman, his incredible influence on American conservatism at that time. How did Galbraith view that?
Well, it's interesting. The 70s was a very important decade for Galbraith's view about the Democratic Party. And, in the last presidential election, where we had in the Democratic Party with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and the tensions between them, one representing kind of like the conservative Democrats and then of the progressive liberal Democrats with Bernie Sanders. And that tension comes out in the letter starting in the 1970s. And basically you had that of Hubert Humphrey and that of Johnson representing the conservative side and that of George McGovern representing the progressive side. And what happened in the early 1970s, the Democratic Party decided to bring in Robert Strauss, who was a lawyer, a Texan lawyer, but based in Washington, D.C., to take over the Democratic National Committee and decided to break away from the progressive side of the Democratic Party with McGovern and to bring in what was called the Southern Democrats. And one of the most important Southern Democrats that he brought in was the young Bill Clinton. And you had John Bowe, you had Sam Nunn, mm-hmm. You had Benson. Galbraith looked at that as being part of the conservative Democratic Party, and they were trying to do everything they could to push out the progressives. And finally what you had was Jimmy Carter, who was elected. And there was a lot of tension between Galbraith and Jimmy Carter. He disagreed with his foreign policy. He disagreed with his domestic policy and argued it was Carter who led the Democratic Party down the wrong path. And so throughout his whole life, the rest of his life from the 1970s to his death, he was constantly fighting the Democratic Party to take on more its progressive side. Mm-hmm. And that debate is still kind of going on. In the 1980s, with the election of Ronald Reagan, the biggest concern that Galbraith had was with nuclear proliferation. He was scared with Reagan's comments about taking on the Russians, the Soviet Union, and to a possible nuclear war. And at that time, he spoke very passionately about trying to do what we can to make sure that a nuclear exchange did not happen. And then secondly, in terms of the economics, of course, was what he called the trickle-down. And his concerns and predictions pretty much came true, where we saw a huge increase in debt. The debt increased by three times under Ronald Reagan. And what pushed that debt was that of military expenditures. And those tensions are still here today.
Well, one of the things about John Kenneth Galbraith's career and character was I keep seeing this time and time again as I read these letters. He had this ability to engage people with whom he disagreed fundamentally, in a way that was very, I guess, for want of a better word, very gentlemanly and you know, with a great deal of respect. And that's something we don't see a lot in the public sphere these days. He had a real ability to do that.
Yes, and but also another part of that, which is very, very important, is that character is more important than that of ideology. And so there's these letters where he is supporting Henry Kissinger to be for Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of controversy, particularly among the progressives, about Henry Kissinger, his role in the Vietnam War, serving with Nixon. He also had Pat Monahan, who also served in the Nixon administration. And Galbraith felt that overall Kissinger played a very important role in finally getting the Vietnam War to come to an end, opening up dialogue with the Soviet Union and that with China. And so you find that even though he had major disagreements with Henry Kissinger, he was a close friend and also supported him becoming Secretary of State. But also you have that of Barry Goldwater, and particularly with that of Bill Buckley.
And I want to play a clip now, because I was extraordinarily surprised to find out how close Galbraith and William F. Buckley Jr. were. But we're going to hear a clip with Galbraith and Buckley. This is from, I think, an early 80s edition of Buckley's program, PBS program, Firing Line.
I'm suggesting that you have exactly given the principal architecture of my own position on how to guard the peace. You say that the Soviet Union is having internal difficulties and under the circumstances is looking for soft parts of the world in which to exercise itself. I don't want to be one of those soft parts.
No, I didn't say that, and I don't think
which we became, we're rapidly becoming under a democratic president.
Oh, I don't think that for a moment, Bill, but there are some points where your aberrations are so vast that I can't contend with them.
Well, did you think we had a missile gap at a time that President Kennedy ran on that issue?
This, I think, was a great mistake of the Democrats at that time. The missile gap, I think, did not turn out to exist.
Was resisting Hitler a great mistake?
I'm forced to confess that I did not at that time have a sufficient awareness of the issues and of the hardware so that I had a useful view. But then we get back to the same tendency, Bill, which I must warn you against. I speak about economics and you go over to the admission of Jewish students to Harvard. I speak of the need for a rational, sensible effort to get these hideous weapons under control, and I find you back with Adolf, of all things, with Adolf Hitler.
That was John Kenneth Galbraith and crossing swords with William F. Buckley Jr. from an edition of Buckley's program Firing Line on PBS. They could really get into some major arguments, and yet they were the best of friends.
Yeah, and I'm really glad we're bringing this up. They were friends for over 40 years, and their friendship was one of the great friendships of all time. But there's an interesting story how they actually met, and they really had a lot of adversity towards one another in the 50s and into the early 60s. And on print was that they were very hard on each other's and their political views and things like that. And then in November 1966, they met by chance in an elevator. And this elevator ride was to Truman Capote's Black and White Ball. And so here they were in this very tight elevator with their wives. And the week before, Galbraith told an economist friend of his not to write for Buckley's National Review magazine. And Buckley confronted him in the elevator about that. So it was a very tense moment in time. And so Galbraith, with his tall height, looked down at Buckley.
He was 6 feet eight or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, 6 feet eight. Wow. And he looked down and he said, "What I said was wrong. I apologized." And before Buckley could respond, the elevator doors open, and then they go into this huge ballroom to meet Truman Capote and Katharine Graham. But it was the beginning of their friendship for 40 years. And one of the things that they decided to do in that friendship was to deal with the issue of civility in politics. They were very much concerned, particularly in the 80s and the 90s, of the tone of discourse. And it wasn't serious. It wasn't playful. It didn't pick up the wit that they believed that opponents should have. And so they consciously decided to work together through public debates to show how one could deal with the issues, to be witty about it, and still be very, very close friends at the very end.
And you mentioned Barry Goldwater. There are also a couple of letters that you have in the book that are exchanges between Galbraith and Barry Goldwater, who was, you know, for a lot of liberals in the 1960s, the great Satan. You know, he was going to be responsible for the nuclear destruction of the entire world, you know, a famous commercial when he was running against Lyndon Baines Johnson. And yet Galbraith really respected Barry Goldwater. And there's a great deal of respect shown in those letters.
Yeah, and in the 1960s, and particularly 1964, Galbraith traveled the country in support of Johnson's re-election as president. And if you read the speeches, he was extremely critical, extremely hard on Barry Goldwater. But on the other hand, as I mentioned earlier, is that he respected character over that of ideology. And when he saw that Goldwater did something that he respected, he would write Goldwater and tell him that. And that was, and he also did this with Nixon also, which is fascinating, is that he would write to Henry Kissinger telling, well, give this to Richard Nixon when he felt that he did the right thing, even though overall he was very, very critical of Nixon, you know, particularly with the Watergate situation.
And the letter, the one letter he wrote to Goldwater, he actually apologizes to Goldwater for being so hard on him during that presidential campaign.
Right. And he was very, very, very hard and went out of his way to do what he could to make sure that Johnson won.
What would Galbraith think of the current level of political discourse in 2017 in the United States?
Oh, you think it all is very silly and very sad, because instead of focusing on the issues that we should be focusing on for the American people and for the United States and our future, is that instead we're getting involved with conversations that are red herrings, that are not focusing on the needs of the American people. And those issues would include that of, again, a balance between public and private goods, the issues of war, and also to get rid of the Scrooge called poverty.
Rick Holt, a professor of economics at Southern Oregon University, editor of the Selected Letters of John Kenneth Galbraith, a fascinating book. Thanks for visiting with us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.